Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Tuesday, the 6th of May. Very nice to have you all with us in Studio A. You're not with us in Studio A. We have a great group in Studio A, but you can hear us as we broadcast from Studio A in downtown Albany, and we are thrilled to have you with us this morning. I will say it's a rainy day. It rained most of the night, and I was walking from my house to my car.
Not a long walk at all.
But there was just like this little sliver of sun, and I thought, wow, it's been a long, long time. But hello and welcome. It's very nice to have you all here. We have a lot to talk about. We have a wonderful group to do it with, and we will get started right away. We, again, welcome you, as always, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we will get underway. Let me introduce the group to you this morning. We welcome Mike Spain to the program. Mike is a former Times Union Associate Editor, and a great pleasure to have Mike with us this morning. Thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you. Very happy to be here.
Well, good. We'll take care of that. Then we welcome Judy Patrick, Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association. Hello. Did that say former? Former Vice President, yes.
Indeed. You know, your bumper music makes me feel like dancing, and dancing makes me feel young, so love it today.
Great. Good, good. That's what we're trying to do. Have you, dance right into getting ready to talk about these very important issues. Hey, speaking of dancers, the Empire Report's J.P. Miller is with us. Hello, J.P., good morning.
That's right. Hey, Joe, I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm well. It's very nice to see you.
Great to see you, too.
Yeah. Then Alexander Mihailovich is with us, Professor Emeritus of Russian at Hofstra University and author of A Liberal Vanguard, Populist Elitism in the United States and Russia. It is a great honor and pleasure to welcome Alexander to the program. How are you?
Doing well. Trying to keep in mind that the maxim of the Russian poet Vladimir Mayakovsky to shine even in cloudy weather. So,
how's that going?
Work in progress.
We're here. We're here.
Yeah.
Yesterday, if you joined us, when I took my Coke Zero bottle out of the refrigerator, it was, hey homies, that's what it said on it. And today, they have the names on them.
I do.
But when you buy the six pack, it's more inclusive. It's more than
thematic.
It's not like Shirley or Carl or Carter or whatever. And this one, so yesterday was homies. Today, pals. So you're pals.
That's
so
nice.
Hello, pals. Good morning. We'll keep you up to date.
Don't be shaking that bottle so much.
No, I know. That has been an issue in the past as well. Okay. Well, let's talk about what's going on in the world, our complicated world that we live in. And I assume that there's always been a complicated nature to our world, and we're trying to we try to figure it out. It does seem especially complicated at this very, very moment. But here we are, and there's a lot to talk about, a lot of things that I think are really interesting. I had asked the group if they just wanted to talk about the Met Gala. They said no. So here we go.
Some cool hats, though.
Yeah, some very, very cool hats. See, Mike was into it.
The Met Gala, for non-political nerds, the Met Gala is like as big as it gets.
Mm. Yeah, it's up there with the Oscars, right? I mean, I think as far as, fashion and outrageousness.
Fashion and also the fact that, Anna Wintour, I don't know exactly how to say her name, but she curates that guest list, and there are some celebrities that are on some years and some celebrities that are off, and it's a very It's a very tough dinner to get invited to. And the beautiful Metropolitan Museum of Art, is there a more beautiful place in New York City? There can't be. Could you imagine having dinner in there and being part of that event? I mean, it would must be spectacular.
It's pretty amazing. Absolutely amazing. Well, it's so we got the chance to talk about it anyway. Isn't that great?
There's a little more, Joe. There's
okay.
There's
fine.
There's unending. You know, you can go to the New York Times, and they must have 200 photographs from yesterday. And then you go to Variety.com, and they have a different 200 photographs. And then you go to the Daily Mail, and they've got all the scandalous photographs. And it's just New York Post. So there, I don't know how many photographers they must have at that. They must have hundreds of photographers there.
I know.
And celebrities, some that you know, some that you don't know. It's amazing.
It's great because there weren't many stories to actually talk about today because everybody was at the Met Gala covering that. So, but we still have things to.
But Rome keeps burning.
And Rome keeps burning. All right, you know, this is a story that has been around for a while, but I feel remiss because we haven't talked about it, and it was in the news again yesterday, so I wanted to bring it up. As something that we spend time on, and it's one of those things that seems like it's could be major at some point, and then also just it's a whole new way of thinking. And this has to do with President Trump's crypto deals. Mm. This is provoking Senate backlash. There are calls for investigation. Some Democrats who had supported legislation for so-called stablecoins are now demanding tougher language to prevent fraud and money laundering. Senate Democrats are demanding changes to cryptocurrency legislation pending in Congress, responding partly to growing evidence that the Trump family is using its connections and President Trump's power to profit from crypto trading. The pushback intensified last week after a closed-door meeting among Senate Democrats in which Senator Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader, told colleagues they should not commit to voting to the so-called Genius Act, a bill backed by, I think you have to go back to Will Rogers, who started by saying, yes, in Washington, when they call something the Genius Act, maybe you should be somewhat wary. It's a bill backed by the crypto industry. For months, the bill had appeared to be gliding toward passage with support from both parties, and it was scheduled for a procedural vote this week. But in the meeting, Senate Democrats expressed concern that the legislation would directly benefit the Trump family's crypto business, citing reporting by the New York Times, which I am reading from right now. Among the concerns the senators raised, according to lawmakers, is that the Trump-affiliated crypto firm World Liberty Financial recently secured a deal to take $2 billion in deposits from a venture fund backed by the government of Abu Dhabi, as the Times reported last week. Who would like to begin our coverage of cryptocurrency? Mike Spain?
Yeah, it's important to note that the World Liberty Financial was a business started by the sons of Donald Trump back in September, so it was perfect timing. Without question, the Trump family has benefited enormously. They get commissions on all this cryptocurrency that gets purchased. But I got to tell you, a lot of people don't really, I'm one of them, don't really understand cryptocurrency that well. And it gets very easily into the woods and hard to follow.
We've had entire programs.
I know.
On this subject to try to explain cryptocurrency. And as of this moment, I'm with you, Mike.
It's a complicated way of doing transactions. Certainly, I trust what people say about it, that it's an easy, it makes it very easy to launder money. It can be in the dark side of things where money can be passed and transactions can happen that there's no government, regulation covering them. And it can probably, I'll bet, evade some taxes, too. And the Biden administration had been implying increased scrutiny and regulation of the crypto industry, and that has kind of stopped suddenly. So Trump stopped that. He brought in people from the crypto industry to regulate, quote-unquote, the crypto industry. And it's just, it's a glimpse into how President Trump has monetized for his own person and his family, monetized the presidency?
Alexander.
Well, I think one thing to to bear in mind about crypto is that it's very much an international currency. And the idea is that we, money can be easily generated, outside of the usual pathways. Here, what's sort of ironic is that it's, preeminently global character is something that on paper one would think that the Trump administration would be against because it doesn't bring jobs to the United States, the crypto industry. The other thing to bear in mind is that it has a very significant bad environmental footprint on the United States. Like wherever they have the crypto plants, one of the things that happens is that they inevitably have to locate these mining plants, which are basically just giant computers, in places that already have an accessible electric grid. So this, in other words, means places that, parts of the country that have experienced deindustrialization. What this does, however, is that you have plants that don't really employ people locally, that have an incredible level of noise pollution output locally. And the other thing is that it's energy that normally should be used for other purposes locally, but is all directed towards this mining industry that is completely global in character. And here I think it's very important to let me give you one example.
Mm-hmm.
In Muskogee, Oklahoma, there's a crypto mining plant that has an energy footprint of what would be the equivalent to 400,000 homes. And why do you need all this energy? Well, basically, it's a kind of like a giant computer that identifies exchanges and then creates these sort of blockchain sequences. And on paper, it's also, it seems to be, all of that is within the public domain. You see you see in a blockchain the actual purchases that are taking and exchanges that are taking place. But who is doing the buying and selling is something that is obscured in that blockchain very often. And so it's an ideal haven for dark money. And so I think it's important to bear in mind, its physical, component, as well as its kind of notional, global market component.
So my question was, after reading this article, if without passing this legislation, what gets changed in the sense of regulation or the fact it's not like it's going to stop it from happening, really, right?
No. As far as I know, no.
No, it'll stay the Wild West. And and that's the thing that I'm really disappointed in, is that the United States benefits in a huge way the fact that we are the global financial center of the world, that people come to bring their companies public in the United States markets. People trust the U.S. dollar, and that trust is slowly deteriorating with current actions in the White House. But our financial system is the envy of the world and is a huge benefit to our country. I think that we want to be the center of cryptocurrency as well. And the fact that we had a bipartisan bill that Democrats, can you imagine Democrats and Republicans getting together and agreeing on something now with Trump in the White House? It's kind of impossible to imagine. Mm-hmm. But Democrats and Republicans were going to come together and pass a bill that would help us regulate stablecoin and cryptocurrency. Stablecoin is a weird thing in that it's a cryptocurrency where they try and they want to match the value of $1 to one stablecoin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And for some reason, that's a very controversial and hard thing to do. But
so a dollar would not be worth a dollar.
Well, a dollar would be worth a dollar. And if you got a stablecoin, let's call it the Joe Donahue stablecoin, that $1, you would get that and then you could exchange it later on for a dollar. Why is this so important? You have to ask the cryptocurrency experts. But there's a company called Tether that was doing this and got into trouble because they were investing poorly and they couldn't give their dollars back when people. It's so. Why not have Democrats and Republicans get together on this. The problem, I think, is that the Trump family is, one, they have a stable coin company, and two, Donald Trump had a meme coin, and it's kind of funny because they're kind of fleecing people on both ends. So they're going to the Abu Dhabis to rip them off. Now, that's the super rich people, right? So they're getting money from them. And then the Trump meme coin, that is their low-dollar donors who are buying a little bit of, you know, why not buy some Trump coin and we can get rich? And so that's – they're fleecing people both on the high end and the low end.
But don't they get access to Trump when they buy a certain level of the meme coin?
I believe that he's going to have a dinner with the top 210 holders of his meme coin. So if you buy enough of his meme coin that he, of course, owns, I think, 25% of the float of, which, you know, the float means the total value of his meme coin, the market cap of it, he owns, I think, something like 25% of it. And the more people that buy it and the higher the value goes up, he owns 25% of that higher value. So I believe that he is going to have a dinner with the top 210 holders to, of course, incentivize people to buy more.
And the very important aspect of this, you mentioned, JP, Tether. Tether is really a kind of a company that houses foreign bitcoins. And so what we're really talking about here is the Trump family creating a structure which enables the exchange or facilitates the exchange of his own bitcoin with foreign bitcoins. And I think that's important to bear in mind.
One minute warning. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. My view is that why this is so bad, I think, is because if it was a real estate deal, you say, okay, Trump has been in real estate for the last 50 years. Okay, he's going to get criticized for real estate, and they're going to invest in real estate. That's their business. But for them to just now be entering this market and creating this is beyond the pale.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll hear from Judy, and we'll continue the conversation. We have letters on this as well. We talk about Trump and the crypto deal that is provoking Senate backlash. We welcome your letters and your thoughts. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we'll continue the conversation on this morning, the Tuesday edition of the roundtable panel for this sixth day of May. We will continue after this news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. And we welcome you. We're talking about Trump's crypto deals, and what a fun topic to start off with, because it's one that I just completely understand. Can I just ask a question? And again, I come to this, admittedly naive on the subject, although I swear to you, I really have tried to learn about the concept. But so you talk about this company that comes out of the Trump enterprise by the two sons. But if you, JP and Joe, decide that they want to start their own crypto coin, we can do that if we have the money, right?
We probably could. We probably don't even need money to do it.
We could
probably just do it.
So the
what are we doing on the radio right now?
So JP, so like the JPJD coin would be, and
I'm
then
in.
Right, and then, but what do you have to like back it? Isn't that one of the problems?
Well, you're asking a guy who I've listened to, I want to say, dozens of hours of podcasts about cryptocurrency. And I know about as much about it now as when I started before I listened to dozens of hours. And I have invested some money in cryptocurrency and not made money on it. Like I would say, most people I talk to that have put money in cryptocurrency, most people have lost. But it's a big industry coming forward, and I do think that we would benefit the United States if we had a solid framework that both Democrats and Republicans agree this is how it should be regulated. I think it's a good thing that the Trump administration has industry experts working in the White House. Having experts work on regulation is better than having people that like me and you working on regulation, because we wouldn't know what we're talking about, right?
But if experts that you pick to regulate, if that's what they're doing, the Bitcoin industry or the crypto industry, rather, are direct beneficiaries of it, and they're tooling it to be continue to be beneficiaries of the industry and want to make money off it, that's a conflict of interest, perhaps?
What I would say is their crypto czar is a guy by the name of David Sacks, who has said, I've listened to him quite a bit, and he said that he has relinquished and sold all of his cryptocurrency and all of his companies that could possibly benefit from cryptocurrency. Now, are there going to be people like the Trump sons on the side making money? Yes, but they're going to make money no matter what. My belief is we need to regulate it in a bipartisan manner such that you don't want China or India or some other country to be the cryptocurrency capital of the world. We want the United States to be the cryptocurrency capital of the world. It's going to benefit us much like it is for us to be the financial center of the world for capital markets, banking, finance, private equity, that.
In that sense, then, Jeff Merkley from Oregon and others, are trying to push for, additions to the bill to keep it from becoming that dark place that Alexander was talking about, where transactions happen and don't get regulated and don't get seen, and that it becomes something that can be monitored so that people who invest a little money in it don't lose it all. And, all the things that, Elizabeth Warren argues about, those protections need to be put in there, not just...
I just wanted to make one comment here in relation to reference to David Sacks. He's a figure from Silicon Valley, and this is something the whole intersection of cryptocurrency and Silicon Valley is a very important one, and a lot of the cryptocurrency market really emerged. It was facilitated by the gamers. The whole gaming community, which was trying to sell some of their desirable avatars to other gamers, and they were using cryptocurrency as a means for doing that. And some of this has had very strange, real, well.
Oh, that's a game, isn't it?
Very strange, real life consequences. Several weeks ago, there was a couple in Connecticut who were kidnapped. And they were going to be used as ransom in regard to a cryptocurrency deal that had gone bad. And a similar incident had occurred in France. And so I think, we need to think, about the way in which Silicon Valley has encouraged a lot of this and is not particularly interested in sort of bolstering up the American economy in the way that, Mike was sort of referring to. I don't know, Judy, if you had any thoughts about this.
I promised many moments ago for you to in on this.
It's a financial system in desperate need of regulation. One of the big problems is both in this age of big money donors, in terms of political donors, both the Democrats and the Republicans recognize the need to not have the crypto industry against you. I mean, just think of what happened to Sherrod Brown. The crypto industry was very much against him, and he got defeated. but it's such a my understanding is the bill that they are talking about, seems doomed at this point, is not strong enough, and it doesn't do enough to prevent people in power from using it to their advantage. You need to regulate it in a way that protects the consumer, who I think the industry is using the confusing elements of cryptocurrency to make it unintelligible to the average person, and so they can just look away. So they can just turn away when Donald Trump has a dinner and requires people to buy $1.2 million in his meme coins before they can attend. When people get hacked, when the ransom asked is often in cryptocurrency. It's almost always asked in cryptocurrency. So this is a real dangerous financial system in need of really serious regulation. And I think Congress needs to do its job, and it needs to the political reality is crypto, it's a very powerful lobbying company. And I don't like the idea. I understand the need to have experts in the room when these regulations are debated, but I want Elizabeth Warren's experts in the room as well to protect the consumer.
Jeremy writes, how is Trump's meme coin not corruption?
I would say it is corruption.
All right.
I would also say, though, that, Judy, you make a great point in that if you and I want to invest in a publicly traded company, that publicly traded company is regulated by the government, has to do quarterly filings, has to do calls with investors, has to have audited financial statements every year. Those publicly traded companies that the retail investor, the small mom and pop investor, it is highly regulated, okay? And so those publicly traded companies can go up and down in value, but you at least have a belief that you're not investing in a total scam. There are exceptions that, of course, like Enron was a scam, but that was a big deal. You're right, the cryptocurrencies that mom and pop investors and small retail investors right now are not regulated in the least. It is not that they are nothing close to publicly traded companies. And I talk to young people, I talk to peers of mine. You know, you hear about people, oh, I invested $100 and all of a sudden it turned into $500,000 3 weeks later. Isn't that great? And you hear about those stories. And the more you talk to people, you hear about the stories of people losing what they've invested long term in crypto.
You know what else that happens in? Gambling.
Gambling, yeah.
I mean, right? Like the track, the casino. I mean, it's online betting. It's very similar in that regard. You hear from the people when they make money, and then you yes. you may or may not hear yes. from people when they lose a lot of money. We got this letter from Guy who says, cryptocurrency is a pyramid scheme. It is novel and interesting, and the underlying technology is interesting at a technical level, but it is the blockchain is unessential to most of the legitimate things it has been pitched as a solution to. Cash is guilty of most of what crypto is, except cash is not a pyramid scheme in and of itself. The pyramid scheme is what is unique about crypto and the ridiculous energy consumption. All right. That's also something I never have fully understood of what a pyramid scheme. that's another story. We go to, let's see, we have just a moment or two before.
I have a vitamin supplement that you could sell and make a lot of money, Joe, if you wanted.
Yes.
You just have to sell it to 10 of your friends as well.
That's right.
And you get 10 of their friends.
Cryptocurrency has been vastly promoted as a legitimate financial instrument via those who have become wealthy with it. A deep dive into cryptocurrency reveals it is a get-rich-quick scheme and not a viable currency. It's far too volatile to be a currency, and it won't show a proof of reserve. Without proper regulations, it has the possibility to bankrupt small coin holders, and it is far too easy to pump and dump. Is that a term? By the
That's
larger
a big term,
coin
yes.
holders, I personally see it as a modern pyramid scheme that needs to be regulated, if not outlawed, and that from John. And then we, let's see, greetings panel. How about asking AI to describe cryptocurrency in simple terms? Perhaps use a prompt like, please explain what cryptocurrency is to me as if I'm a six-year-old. Maybe that. We'll provide some clarity.
I'm going to do that.
We'll give it a try during the break. We'll take a break. We'll be back. More to come right after this. You say I'm hurt. I will take your word. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our program this morning. We welcome you and your input, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. All right, the second story to discuss this morning, President Trump calling for 100% tariff on foreign-made films to save, quote, dying Hollywood. This is a story that has caused some notice, but also an embrace by much of Hollywood that say that they need help. President Trump called for a 100% tariff on movies produced overseas in a Truth Social post, confounding studio executives and critics about what this could mean for the heavily globalized film industry. The movie industry in America is dying a very fast death, the president wrote. This is a concerted effort by their nations and therefore a national security threat. It is, in addition to everything else, messaging and propaganda, he wrote. Therefore, I am authorizing the Department of Commerce and the U.S. Trade Representative to immediately begin the process of instituting a 100% tariff on any and all movies coming into our country that are produced in foreign lands. We want movies made in America again, all shouty caps with an exclamation point. And that is where that stands at the moment. Howard Lutnick, not to be outdone, said in response, "Don't worry, we're on it."
Yeah, I would like to take this on, or to begin to take this on. I'm very interested what others have to say about this. As for starters, you talked about the confounding of things. One of the things that Trump is doing is confounding the production of films in other countries with footage that is done in other countries but ultimately goes to American studios. Right. He says, you know, we are against, you know, films being produced in other lands. Produced in what sense? Made or bankrolled? You know, these are very different things. Right. And all of the companies that are going to be affected by this are American ones. Netflix, Disney, Warner Brothers, and Paramount. And I just want to sort of give a couple of examples here to sort of like flesh out this distinction between, you know, produced in the sense of, you know, bankrolled and sort of created as opposed to made in other countries, physically made in other countries. And I'd like to go specifically to the example of Pinewood Studios in the UK,
right,
which is in Buckinghamshire. Now, this has been one of the largest complexes for making movies. American studios have been filming movies at Pinewood for decades. Almost every single Star Wars movies up until the series that have been more recently made were filmed primarily at Pinewood. But these were filmed by American studios, and the profits went to the American studios, even though the actual physical filming occurred overseas. And during the late 70s and the early 80s, there was a whole spate of articles in the UK media about how American studios were exploiting the facilities of the UK film industry and really giving nothing back. All right. So in other words here, the important thing to bear in mind is that one can film elsewhere, but then the money is ultimately goes back to the parent company. And so one of the things that occurs in the 1980s in the UK film industry, there's a whole discussion about Pinewood and, you know, how to revive the UK film industry. And there was a joke running around that time that the James Bond franchise essentially saved the British film industry, bankrolled it, because at that time it was owned by a British company, Eon Films, and it was also filming at Pinewood. And so I'm kind of baffled by this whole obsession that Trump has about films that are made physically elsewhere. Because this is a kind of a completely artificial distinction if the money is ultimately going back to an American company.
One high-level film industry executive told the Los Angeles Times, "Nobody knows what this means, and I don't suspect we will for a while. Is it on domestically funded foreign productions? Is it on foreign-funded ones? Is the tariff on film revenues or film costs on these projects, or both?" Meanwhile, Governor Gavin Newsom called on Trump to create a federal film tax credit program that provides at least $7.5 billion in incentives to studios that film in the U.S. The governor reached out to the White House Monday evening to encourage Trump to work with California to create a federal credit modeled after the state's program with the goal of boosting domestic production.
Film credits. We in New York do film credits. We give, I think, something like $800 million a year of our taxpayer dollars go to production companies like the folks that make Saturday Night Live and Blue Bloods. And what I think the president is going to find on this tariffs overture that he made yesterday is that the cat is, with the global economy that we have, the cat is out of the bag on penalizing foreign countries in terms of them exporting their goods to the United States. Everything that we enjoy every day, everything in this studio is, of course, built from components made around the world by American companies, by foreign companies, and this is no different. You know, the very well-articulated points that you brought up, Alexander, is the same with every single industry, whether it's film, whether it's cars, whether it's electronics, whether it's airplanes. The cat is out of the bag in terms of us enjoying the benefits of the global economy. And Trump is going to run into the same issues with this as he has with the other tariffs.
Yeah, and in terms of the film and television industry, the cat has been out of the bag for a really long time. You know, in the 1980s, there were any number of network television series that were filming primarily in Vancouver or Toronto. Yeah. Why? Because it was cheaper to film there. All right, and I don't see how we're at a place that is fundamentally different from that time. The other thing to bear in mind is that, the view that's often articulated, by countries and regions where filming actually takes place, but where the parent company is located completely elsewhere, is that our human and physical resources are getting exploited. Now, sometimes there's a kind of a marginal beneficial interaction that is sort of mutual. For example, what would the pool of unemployed theater actors in New York City be without Dick Wolf's enormous Law and Order franchise? Because so many of them were hired by that series and actually earned pretty good money, and were able to sort of maintain themselves, in between theater stints in New York City. But at the same time, none of those people actually, made significant leaps onto the silver screen, or became, very few of them became kind of prominent names that way. So, that's pretty much all I have to say about this. I don't know what other people think about these issues. But
I want to, just quickly to point out that the call to enhance U.S. production comes after Donald Trump tapped a trio of actors, John Voight, Sylvester Stallone, and Mel Gibson, who's packing heat now, to be his special ambassadors to Hollywood.
Right, and the question, there are a million questions with this. How would they collect it? Who does it apply to TV shows? Do streaming series, are they included? How about YouTube shows? Is that included? Certainly, the movie industry has had a hard time because they're facing this increased competition from streaming services, and the pandemic was tough on them as well. And they are struggling to come back. Producing anything in California is expensive, and that is why Newsom is trying to give them enhanced tax credits. The debate about whether or not to give entertainment industry any tax credit is real. We had it in New York. We continue to have it because it does bring industry. Whenever there's a local film production, I mean, we make a big deal of it here in Albany and in Schenectady.
Yeah,
it has an economic impact when they go to the local restaurants.
Why do you need 200 films when you could just have two or three films? and those films could star Sylvester Stallone, Mel Gibson, and John Voight.
Well, let me just point out that the sequel to The Passion of the Christ that Mel Gibson is currently undertaking until this point, the plan was that it would be filmed entirely outside of the U.S.
Yes.
So I'm not sure how he can continue to serve as an ambassador to the film industry for Trump while having this particular project at hand.
Mike.
Yeah, there's so much to say. You know, California is also competing with Georgia and New York State, who all give big incentives to the film industry there. And it's reasonable to talk about ways to make it cheaper for filmmakers to do their work in California. There's a lot of advantages, and the disadvantage is just the high cost. But, I mean, what happens if the federal government starts, pumping billions into this, and then Trump starts to say, well, that movie's about DEI, and I don't think that one ought to be made. Would they ever have made The Apprentice, the story of how, Roy Cohn mentored the young Donald Trump to make him what he is today? I mean, what? It is so messed up in so many ways. Like, how do you levy the tariff against who? I mean, we're all talking about the ascendancy of the new pope, and everyone is talking about conclave. Where are you going to make that? You build the Sistine Chapel in Southern California now, and then tear it down at the end? I mean, they made it in Italy. It made a lot of sense.
That part does make sense. I will say, if you're looking for a show that's made locally, but the new Netflix series, The Four Seasons, mm-hmm. is done almost. This is with Tina Fey and Steve Carell. The Hudson Valley is prominent. Mm-hmm. Beacon plays a really large role in it, and it's and by the way, it's absolutely gorgeous.
It is.
It's really, really good.
Nicely filmed.
Beautiful film. All right. But you bring up a great point. It's like the White Lotus from Albuquerque. We'll take a break and we'll return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion on this Tuesday, the 6th of May. Very nice to have you with us. We welcome J.P. Miller from the Empire Report, Judy Patrick, former Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Mike Spain, former Times Union Associate Editor, and Alexander Mihailovich, who is Professor Emeritus of Russian at Hofstra University and author of the book A Liberal Vanguard. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We have several letters on the U.S. film industry and the proposal that is underway, the tariffs that the president has called for in his Truth Social tweet. Ricky says the 100% tariffs on films not made in America is, I believe, mostly targeted at Canada. Production, post-production, and other costs are lower in Canada due to special tax breaks offered by the Canadian government to filmmakers. This is another way to antagonize our neighbors to the north. Then we go to John. There's an obvious and really simple explanation for this whole tariff on Hollywood-made movies nonsense, shouty caps. Trump wants control, shouty caps, of Hollywood. Trump thinks by leveling tariffs on Hollywood, he'll be able to make Hollywood do what he wants in the same way that he's made other countries come to him hat in hand since starting his international tariff war. Remember, the right sees quote-unquote Hollywood and the entertainment industry in general as woke infection on par with universities. It's an enemy, and they need to destroy it.
I think that's a really good letter. I worry about efforts to, once you start giving money to a entity, you start to put strings on that money. And what does that mean?
Michelle writes to us and says, didn't the administration just cut funding to the NEA? They don't value artists and creativity and education. How could we have a thriving film industry when artists aren't supported and are struggling in an economy that threatens recession? That's a really great point. Very good letter. Thank you, Michelle, for sharing that with us. Elizabeth says, if Trump wants to encourage more movie production in the U.S., then offer subsidies. If you want to stop something, then you tax it. Think cigarettes. His ignorance about basic economics is astounding. Finally, we go to Kate. I'm not certain about this, but isn't there a law against imposing tariffs on intellectual property? In any case, at what point in the production and distribution process would the tariffs be applied? Well, we don't know the answer to that, as little information has been shared thus far.
And the rationale for the tariffs, as cited by the president, was the crisis the industry is in is a national emergency.
Yes.
That's right. He would need that designation in order to do it. That's the law.
And it's time, perhaps, once again, for Congress to step up and say, no, this isn't a national emergency. Let us decide when to impose tariffs, as is our constitutionally detailed duty. But instead, they will walk away from this.
12 minutes past 10 o'clock, we move on and go to this story on Russia and Ukraine. Since ceasefire talks began, life in Ukraine has become more dangerous, according to the United Nations. Russian strikes and fighting along the front line have killed far more civilians than over the same period 1 year ago. That, according to UN officials in a presentation for diplomats in New York this week. With the beginning of ceasefire talks and the war between Russia and Ukraine, life has become riskier. That, according to a tally of civilian deaths by the UN and analysts reviewing recent Russian strikes. Since the talks began in February, Russian missile and drone strikes and fighting along the front line have killed far more civilians than over a year ago. This in the first 24 days of April, for example, 848 civilians were killed or wounded, a 46% increase over the same period last year, according to the UN. At the same time, Russia has been targeting cities more intensively. Just last month, hitting a playground, pedestrians on a crowded sidewalk, and an apartment building. An analysis of recent strikes shows this, and in the fighting on the ground, Russia opened a new offensive in the north, east, and south. Ukraine's top military commander said this on April 9th. Alexander.
Well, I think one of the things that's happening is that Russia is simply continuing what it's always been doing, you know, during this conflict, which is not to respect the ceasefires, or seeing them as basically just temporary placeholders. I think we need to remind ourselves of some relatively positive developments in Ukraine that are recent. The mineral deal, which hasn't gotten a lot of attention, but the mineral deal that was signed last week by the United States and Ukraine is actually a much better deal than the one that was initially submitted by J.D. Vance, Keith Kellogg, and Trump to Ukraine, which resulted in that acrimonious February 28th meeting that was in the Oval Office. This one creates the possibility for cooperation between the two countries, between the U.S. and Ukraine, in such a way as to encourage rebuilding of the country and development. It's estimated that it would take $450 billion to rebuild Ukraine as a result of the Russian invasion. And this new mineral deal essentially creates a realistic possibility for that happening. It also, very importantly, does not articulate American support as a debt that has to be paid back by Ukraine, right? And it doesn't articulate the military aid and humanitarian aid that was given by the Biden administration to Ukraine as a debt that has to be repaid. Those conditions were ones that Vance and Trump were very keen on insisting on, and that's off the table now. So that's good. The other aspect of this, I just want to very quickly, you know, point out that U.S. aid has significant U.S. military aid to Ukraine has resumed, and now Patriot missiles are being sent as a result to Ukraine to fight the Russian invasion. So these are kind of interesting developments. I think that. Gone under the wire because the Trump administration doesn't want to, you know, draw attention to the fact that essentially Ukraine and Zelensky have very effectively advocated for on their own behalf and fought for their interests, and that the Trump administration clearly sees now that Putin is not interested in honoring any kind of ceasefire agreement. So one sort of embarrassing moment last week was that Trump implored Putin on on Truth Social to stop the bombardment of civilian targets. Vladimir, please stop. And there's an aspect of this that simply signals weakness, and that Trump's and the Trump administration more broadly has been trying not to draw attention to. So there's been a lot of kind of quiet, practical diplomacy that I think is, you know, the Trump team's recognition that their approach up until this point has not worked in regard to getting Russia to the table in a way that would honor any kind of agreement.
Judy?
Yeah, I think Donald Trump got played by Putin. Trump thought by giving Russia whatever they wanted in terms of recognizing their control of you know, parts of Ukraine that they had seized years ago, at the outset was a good move, and it was not a good move for the brilliant deal maker. I think he has been outplayed, and the question is whether or not this will translate into renewed support for Ukrainian aid from the American public. I had seen the Republican MAGA movement increasingly not support Ukraine and increasingly support a deal that would give Russia whatever it wanted as they continue to ban civilian targets and little kids on playgrounds getting killed. I think you will see renewed support among the American public.
Yeah. Judy, just to build on that comment, about the playground atrocity, that was actually in Zelensky's hometown of Kryvyi Rih, and it was on Palm Sunday. So much of the war up until, you know, really from the very beginning, already in 2014, which is the actual beginning of the war, rather than the official announcement of it in February 2022, so much of it has been framed by the Putin administration, not about NATO. It's not even about, Ukraine joining the EU. It's about this kind of culture war between the values of Ukraine and the values of the Russian Federation, much of which members of the Putin administration has been framing about religion. I don't have time now to sort of talk about, like, the whole religious dimension of this war, which is very peculiar. In terms of, the tension between Russian Orthodoxy and Ukrainian Orthodoxy right now. But I will say this, is that it's clearly a kind of a sign of, supreme contempt to target Zelensky's hometown on Palm Sunday, which for the Orthodox is that whole week preceding Easter is the most important part of the religious calendar. More important even than Christmas. So I think it just signals, the sense in which all of those earlier talking points are now just kind of subsumed by this general rage at the possibility of a more substantial Ukrainian sovereignty that has nothing to do fundamentally with Russian influence.
JP?
What I thought was interesting in the article you sent around, Joe, was that they say that increased violence amid peace talks is not necessarily an indication that the peace talks are going bad because these militaries want to get in their quote-unquote last licks before, there's no more war. And so I thought it was a weird thing to read, but that's what they had in the New York Times.
They want to gain ground, I guess.
Yeah, they want to. Maybe I'm wrong. You could correct me, Alexander, yeah. But I was reading about that. And so that maybe gives me some hope that maybe the war is ending soon or no?
No. No, not necessarily. And that particular opinion was offered by Samuel Cherup from the RAND Corporation. Mm. And he's, from the very beginning of this conflict, he's been kind of, I wouldn't say he's an apologist for the Putin administration, but he's somebody who's been kind of minimizing the possibility, the realistic possibility of Ukrainian sovereignty. I actually respectfully disagree with his opinion, and that opinion that was quoted by the Times.
And the story also talked about the idea of generating incredible fear among the civilian population to put pressure on Zelensky to come to the peace table and concede important elements. And indeed, these the Ukrainian people have been living under such terror for 3-4 years now. It must put pressure on Zelensky, but I think they've held on this long. You can only hope that the U.S. will increase its ability to help them. I mean, at one point, the U.S. had withdrawn, had stopped sharing
military intelligence.
And so let's hope some of that comes back. It just seems so odd that Donald Trump thought his initial play would work, and it didn't.
You know, you make a good point there, that these personal relationships between world leaders can vastly change the dynamic of wars and, you know, countries' sovereignty, et cetera. I mean, after World War II at Yalta, FDR was actually getting into a good relationship with Joseph Stalin, which might have changed the whole outcome of the second half of the 20th century. But he died. FDR died, and Harry Truman had a whole different way of looking at them. I mean, just your personal relationship. And the fact, as you were pointing out, Judy, that Putin pretty much has snubbed Trump in his effort, you know, with Trump's pleas to stop the bombing of civilian targets, whatever. It may drive Trump into the camp of Ukrainian sovereignty, and he may try to own that and claim that victory. And if it happens, all power to him.
Yeah, I mean, I think there have been some other positive developments. We have to interpret, the current tactics of the Russian Federation, perhaps in other ways that weren't touched upon by that New York Times article. Specifically, Ukraine has actually had some fairly substantial military victories lately against the Russian Federation. For the first time, one of their maritime drones shot down a Russian fighter plane. You know, and that's huge. And they've actually outpaced the Russian Federation in terms of the sophistication of their drone capabilities. And also, one of the four regions that Russia now since 2022, considered to be a part of the Russian Federation, Kherson, is now, the Russian victory there is far from guaranteed. There have been sort of significant inroads, by the Ukrainian military upon that territory, regaining it. So we'll see. I think that this is also a sign, Putin wants to demoralize the Ukrainian populace, but he also, this is a sign of, desperation, I think.
Anybody else?
Desperation on Putin's part?
On Putin's part.
Because what are the Russian people? I mean, are they starting to, as their sons come home in body bags, are they starting to lose confidence?
I think they are. There are, surveys that point in that direction. I think that there's a sense of, there's a sense of no real future in the Russian Federation for young people. Now the birth rate has hit an all-time low in the Russian Federation, the lowest it's been in recent memory. And, it seems, based on some of the surveys that have been conducted, is that, many, many men and women, especially women, are not interested in making their families larger for a future whose economic and material stability is so unclear, and there's a sense of kind of general, cynicism and, a sense of demoralization, Why would they, why would they bring new life into a world where, their boys, their male children will ultimately be used as cannon fodder, in the 2000s, there was a feminist group in St. Petersburg, which had this sort of, very amusing and witty protest action where they dressed in nurses' smocks, dabbed themselves in red paint, and they wrote across their smocks, "Give birth to meat," because this is essentially, in some ways, what the Russian Federation is, you know, is currently in this moment, whereas that's what you are doing if you're bringing new life into the world.
We have just a few moments before the bottom of the hour break, but I would like to ask the other story that happened over the weekend that we mentioned yesterday. But Marco Rubio now has two hats. One is Secretary of State. The other, of course, as President Trump's interim national security advisor. Marco Rubio had been leading the charge on this since disastrous. I think that's a safe term. Oval Office meeting. Where are we right now as far as the United States in working on some sort of peace effort?
Does
the fact that you have somebody who is stretched now even more thin have an effect on that?
So I think that there are two aspects of this. One is that they've put the peace efforts on hold because of, you know, the embarrassment at, you know, Putin's lack of interest in honoring it. But they've tried to compensate in other ways with this, you know, this new mineral deal, which, although it does not occur, does not include a security provision, security would obviously be an important precondition for the deal to become realizable, because you cannot, you know, extract any minerals with, you know, in a state of war. So there's that aspect of it. There's a sense of, the, you know, that encouraging this deal with signing this deal with Ukraine would be a way of, you know, introducing through the fire door the idea of security for the region, that the United States would be potentially interested in guaranteeing it. The other aspect of this, I think, is that the Trump team under Rubio, I think, is becoming increasingly aware of its irrelevance to making peace possible in Ukraine, because European countries are already stepping up to the plate to provide military assistance to Ukraine, also increasing their military budgets. So this is a kind of a workaround, you know, for providing security assistance to Ukraine without actually having Ukraine become a member of NATO, right? You would have different, kind of a loose coalition of European countries offering assistance and intelligence in lieu of membership. So, because membership now is not going to happen at this moment because of the fact that the U.S. and Hungary would vote against it, so...
All right, we are going to take a break. When we come back, we will finish up the show with this terrific group, and we welcome your letters. Last call, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We would love to hear from you. First, some messages and news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us on this Tuesday morning, as it is every morning. And we welcome you to the program if you're just joining us. We'd love to hear from you, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Just a reminder, you no doubt have been hearing both on the station and throughout the land about the trials and tribulations of executive orders and the effect that they have on national public radio and public media in general. Anything you can do to help right now is essential. We would love to hear from you. All you have to do is go to wamc.org, and there is a link there, and you can simply go to it and assist. You can also call us 1-800-323-9262, 1-800-323-WAMC. A lot to make up for and a lot of help that we need from our audience, and we come to you realizing that it's a big ask, but by the same token, it's a big loss to us of what is potentially, we assume, being taken away. We'll know more. That's one of the issues, too, is trying to explain exactly what's going on when you don't really know exactly what's going on. So we're figuring that out, and that certainly is not alone. This issue is not alone. Many of these issues that we're talking about still have more questions than answers attached to them. But any way that you can help us and make us stronger in this difficult time, we would appreciate it. 1-800-323-9262 or WAMC.org. Just a few minutes left with this terrific group. Let me go to our next story. And we, again, welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. I do want to check in on, we were talking about Russia. I would like to talk about what is happening in Gaza as well. And another case of a story that we have obviously been following, but it's been a week or so since we have checked in to talk about specifically what is going on. The New York Times reporting that Trump's hope for the Gaza deal has faded as Israel plans a major escalation. When President Trump hosted Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel at the White House in early April, a reporter reminded Mr. Trump that his 2024 campaign promise to end the war in Gaza remained unfulfilled. Israel had recently broken a tenuous ceasefire in its 18-month war with Hamas and renewed its bombardment of Gaza, but Mr. Trump professed optimism. "I'd like to see the war stop," he replied, "and I think the war will stop at some point that won't be in the too distant future." 1 month later, prospects for peace in Gaza have dimmed even further. Mr. Netanyahu warned on Monday of an intensive Israeli escalation in the Palestinian enclave after his security cabinet approved plans to call up tens of thousands of reservists for a fresh assault there. Israeli hawks insist that only force can pressure Hamas into finally releasing the more than 20 hostages it still holds captive to end the conflict. But many analysts say a major Israeli escalation could kill any hope left for peace. That from the New York Times. Judy.
And in the meantime, the civilian population in Gaza needs food. There are children starving there, and aid relief has been blocked. And so we're not getting the kind of relief that is needed for that population. You know, I reread the piece, "The War Will End in the Not Too Distant Future." What does that mean? Will it be in the distant future, or will it be in the immediate future? He talks so imprecisely that it is so hard to determine exactly what he's talking about. I think he's just thrown up his hands. He's realized that ending a war, just like he has encountered in Ukraine, is a lot easier than running a casino or completing a deal for real estate in New York City. International diplomacy is a lot more complicated. I think he needs to set the strategy and let the tactics for the professional diplomats, if there are any left.
Mike.
Yeah. We talked a little bit about Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State and the current national security guy, also being spread too thin. Well, Trump has pretty much designated his pal, Steve Witkoff, to be the negotiator for the Mideast. And Witkoff has been in Iran trying to negotiate some kind of nuclear deal. He's also involved in the whole Russian-Ukraine thing. I mean, it sounds like they have a limited amount of expertise, as Judy points out, in diplomacy, and that limited amount of expertise is being spread rather thinly, and they're just not capable of the kinds of muscle and the kinds of finesse that are historically necessary to resolve these awful international situations.
Alexander.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out that the the language that Trump is using right now in regard to Israel and Gaza is almost identical to moments of frustrations that he's expressed recently about Ukraine. We want the fighting to stop. And it's always in the passive voice, like, you know, as if the fighting is occurring independently of, you know, different combatants in different countries or different, you know, sort of warring factions. And so I think that he's throwing up his arms in regard to Israel. And he's, you know, many, you know, commentators, you know, on both sides of the divide, you know, discuss, you know, of, you know, the issue of Gaza have said that, you know, he's basically, you know, he's now doesn't want to be involved and he's handing over the reins to Netanyahu to do whatever he wants. And actually, Trump had wording very similar to that several weeks ago. He says, you know, that Benjamin Netanyahu should finish the job that he set out to do in Gaza, right? I think that clearly the Trump administration was not in possession of kind of, you know, a granular understanding of the nature of what was happening in Gaza. So that's a big part of it as well.
JP?
Yeah, and I think it's also not smart to say, well, I want the fighting to end. You know, they're going to be fighting there in 10 years and 20 years and 100 years, and that's how it's going to be. And with the current situation right now, I can understand why Hamas doesn't want to give up their 20 hostages, because mm-hmm. that's a whole lot of leverage. Yeah. It's their only leverage that they have are those 20 hostages. Mm-hmm. And I understand from Israel's standpoint how they want to get those people back or the bodies back or whatever you have, but we're going to be on the round table in 500, 1,000 years talking about fighting there. It's just going to keep going.
Well, I'll speak for yourself. I have great hope. I mean, 25 years now, we'll take on the world, yes. Anybody else on that before we go to the weirdest story of the day?
I mean, I think that Netanyahu, what's happening with him right now, by all indications, is that many parts of Israeli society that were formerly, had unquestioning, you know, support of him, are now getting very shaky and are like very unhappy. Mm. By all indicators, this includes, you know, parties like center-right parties that were supporting him. That this is, you know, that the return of the hostages is taking so long. And that many other, you know, issues in Israeli society are just not being addressed as a result of this focus on, you know, the campaign in Gaza.
Yesterday on the show, we talked about the post, both on Truth Social as well as the White House account, that showed the president of the United States in an AI-generated image as dressed up as the Pope. There was backlash from Catholics and others around the country and around the world saying that it was inappropriate and that especially in a time of mourning of the last Pope who just passed away and the just days before, hours before, cardinals were to convene to look to name a new pope. Flags are still at half staff, and many just thought it was tone deaf. The president yesterday did, and I understand, I just think this is worth talking about because it is... It continues what we were talking on yesterday of what do you do when you've created a situation like this? Well, the thing that you do is you say, I had nothing to do with it. That's what he said yesterday. He said he was taking questions in the White House. Somebody made up a picture of me dressed like the Pope, and they put it out on the Internet. That's not me. I didn't do that. I have no idea where it came from. Maybe it was AI. But I have no idea where it came from. It wasn't me. Mr. Trump responding to a question about Catholics who are displeased with the images of him dressed in white papal robes and a ceremonial headdress also attempted to downplay the mounting criticism. They can't take a joke? Mr. Trump asked, quickly telling the reporter, you don't mean the Catholics, you mean the fake news media. They care. The Catholics loved it.
Maybe it was AI. Do you mean maybe he actually did dress up like that?
Yes, maybe it was. and it would be horrible if he did dress up as a.
And maybe he did and
didn't remember. Right. That's concerning too.
You know what's really fascinating about this story is there's so much outlandish, inappropriate, crude posts that he has put out. Or his team has put out, but this one is one he feels like being an 8-year-old kid saying, "Oh, it wasn't me." I mean, I wonder what it was about this one that made him feel like he needed to say, "Oh, it wasn't me." Of course, it was him. He nothing gets posted under his name without him knowing about it.
The other thing too, Mike, that I thought about this is especially the thing about Catholics not being upset about it. Cardinal Dolan of New York, just one who spoke out against it, and cardinals across the world have spoken out against it, as well as bishops and other members of the clergy. But the fact that you and correct me if I'm wrong, I'll post this to anybody, but in the first Trump administration. They probably would have. It seemed to me the MO was you take it down and then you just distance yourself from it, and now you keep it up and you say, "Oh, I got there. I don't know. It's probably that guy from the Atlantic."
Yeah. Well, that's part of it. It's sort of the which answer do you want? It's almost the way they're answering all the questions about the guy in the Abrego Garcia in the El Salvador jail, you know, or prison. You know, they just make up and change the answer every single time. First of all, I don't think Trump made this. I think somebody out on the internet made it and put it up there. I find it offensive. I think the cardinals are offended by it because it's so soon after Pope Francis passed away. And making it worse is Trump was the antithesis of Pope Francis. Trump hates immigrants. He hates poor people. And that's all that Francis stood for. But on top of all that, after it all happens and he posts it on his Truth Social and the White House posts it on their account, he says he has the audacity to say, "Hey, don't believe what you see. Believe what I'm telling you. I had nothing to do with it. I didn't do it." Of course he did it. And then to make a joke that Catholics like it. I mean, we all make fun of our own faith, our own ethnicity a little bit. And I like a joke about the Pope as much as anybody else, but not an offensive joke.
I know. I just have to say we're out of time, but and I apologize to those who I won't get to this morning. But it is rich to think about blaming fake news for an AI-generated image. I mean, I'm just that, yeah. Like, but there you go. We're out of time. My thanks to Judy and Mike and Alexander and JP Miller. We will be back right after this.